It was June 1950, and the morning dawned quiet and bright at the Cohens' old New York brownstone. But Morris and Lona Cohen were anything but sunny. The Rosenbergs had just been apprehended. When an unexpected knock rattled the front door, they immediately jumped to the worst conclusion. They'd been found out, too. Another knock. There wasn't time to think. Morris made his way towards the door. Oh, thank goodness. It was Yuri Sokolov, a high-ranking Soviet spy. Not the FBI. Lona emerged from behind Morris, but Yuri put a finger to his lips. He urgently gestured for a pen and paper. His quickly scribbled message read, "You have to leave tonight." Morris and Lona's eyes widened. Yuri scribbled another note. "Burn these as I write them." It wasn't safe to speak. Their apartment might be bugged, and the building under watch. Other volunteer networks were being rounded up. It was only a matter of time before Morris and Lona were arrested. Morris paced the floor as Yuri urgently churned out note after note. Lona burned them immediately. They were to leave that night and carry nothing with them but the wallets in their pockets and the clothes on their backs. Anything else posed a risk of unwanted attention. Their friends and family must be left behind. They should contact no one. Morris silently protested, but Yuri insisted. The prosecutor had asked for the death penalty for the Rosenbergs. Did they want the same fate? If they valued their lives, they had to leave immediately. This is Espionage, the Parcast original exploring the missions of the world's most incredible spies and what brought their covert operations into the public eye. Now, throughout this show, we'll explore real-world spy tactics required to impersonate, exploit, and infiltrate the most confidential places in the world. I'm Carter Roy. You can find all episodes of Espionage and all other Parcast originals for free on Spotify or wherever you listen to podcasts. To stream Espionage for free on Spotify, just open the app and type Espionage in the search bar. At Parcast, we are grateful for you, our listeners. You allow us to do what we love. Let us know how we're doing. Reach out on Facebook and Instagram at Parcast and Twitter at Parcast Network. And if you enjoy today's episode, the best way to help is to leave a 5-star review wherever you're listening. It really does help. Well, this is our first episode on notorious atomic spies Morris and Lona Cohen. In 1945, the couple provided the Soviet Union with a complete diagram and description of the Allied atomic bomb, expediting the development of Russia's own A-bomb and giving them a substantial advantage during the Cold War. This week, we'll explore how two American activists were drawn to a life of treason. Next week, we'll examine how their plans were thwarted and their spy ring unraveled. It was a hot New York City night in July 1937, and the Communist Party USA was holding a rally for the North American Committee to Aid Spanish Democracy. Well, that is, a rally to support the Spanish Loyalists, a communist group against their fascist opponents. The Spanish were in the midst of a civil war, and Stalin and communists everywhere knew the outcome was crucial. If the Loyalists won, they'd add Spain to the Soviet sphere of influence and vastly expand Soviet power over the entire Mediterranean. Of course, it was more generally acceptable to simply say the communists were protecting Spain from fascism. Anti-fascist rhetoric, after all, never failed to stir a sense of purpose in young radicals, like Morris Cohen. Morris had personal reasons to feel inspired by the rallying cries of Soviet leaders preaching justice and equality. He was born to Harry and Sarah Cohen, Jewish immigrants from Eastern Europe who settled in the Bronx. And when the stock market crash of October 1929 threw a large portion of the U.S. into economic ruin, it didn't spare the Cohens. A then college-aged Morris was forced to drop out of NYU. Morris was well aware that the Great Depression was largely caused by economic inequality. The upper classes accounted for a third of all wealth, while the lower classes had no savings at all. This injustice tore through Morris. And he wasn't alone. At the rally, the summer heat was thick, but the energy in Madison Square Garden was high. The crowd rocked with cheers as Socialist and Communist Party leaders Norman Thomas and Earl Browder took the stage. They condemned Britain and America for not arming loyalist Spain, for letting the underdog fight alone. This struck a chord in Morris. He empathized with the underdog, because he was one. 2 years earlier, in the summer of 1935, Morris had waited tables at high-end Jewish resorts in the Catskills. He and his fellow employees were paid paltry wages to cater to A-list high rollers like Sid Caesar and Danny Kaye. The experience had aggravated his growing frustrations with the class divide. But it also showed him that he could do something about the problem. He and his colleagues joined strikes with other hotel employees to express their dissatisfaction. That same year, the 25-year-old Morris joined an offshoot of the Young Communist League, called the National Student League. He devoted himself to the cause, organizing anti-war rallies and mobilizing recruits. By 1937, Morris had a reputation as a skilled agitprop organizer, a Russian abbreviation for agitation and propaganda. But even such a devoted young comrade could be distracted, and the night of the 1937 rally, Morris's attention was split. He couldn't stop thinking about that young woman with honey blonde hair and an enticing silhouette. She was a communist, too. Morris had just met her that day, right before the rally. The perfect girl. But Morris couldn't let his new love interest stop him from doing what was right. That night, party leaders asked for volunteers to fight for loyalist Spain, and Morris, heart pounding in his chest, stepped forward. This was the moment to act on his beliefs, to truly fight for the underdog, and perhaps it would even impress that sweet, blonde-haired woman. 2 days and one forged passport later, Cohen was aboard a steamboat to Europe. The beginning of his service in Spain, however, was not auspicious. Morris suffered 2 machine gun wounds, 1 to each thigh. But his faith in the communist movement remained unshakable. As soon as he regained his strength and mobility, Morris resumed his agitprop duties from his recovery ward in Murcia, Spain. He was determined to win over colleagues for the communist cause. Small acts of kindness earned him the trust of fellow patients. Then he shared the party mission. This clever, intuitive approach attracted the attention of party leaders. One of Morris's superiors reported, "His work while in the hospital has been some of the best. He has a fine sense of what the comrades want and how to develop the work around their needs. Fine skills for a spy." When Morris was discharged from the hospital in March of 1938, he received an invitation. Morris looked at the piece of paper in his hands and then up towards the big villa set back from the road. He checked the address again. Well, this was the spot. As he approached the gate, intrigue and excitement consumed him. A handsome, muscular man greeted him, introducing himself as Companiero Brown. Brown lavished Morris with praise, telling him he had been highly recommended by the 15th. KGB historian Vladimir Chikov believes that Companiero Brown was an alias for Alexander Orlov, a Czechist who had fought with the Reds in the Russian Civil War. The villa was his domain, a haven in which he molded and shaped the next generation of guerrilla fighters. Orlov operated 6 guerrilla sabotage schools in Madrid, Valencia, and Barcelona. And he vetted his recruits carefully. Orlov's eyes bore into Morris's, searching. Finally, he asked pointedly, what were Morris's feelings towards Russia? This was a test. According to Cohen biographer Barnes Carr, Morris replied that he felt the USSR was leading the way in building a free society, and that he was committed to a worldwide communist revolution. Orlov was satisfied. Morris was the perfect recruit. But there was a small problem. His injuries from fighting with the 15th made him unfit for guerrilla warfare. And anyway, his talents seemed to be intellectual rather than physical. He'd have to be sent to the intelligence school in Barcelona to train for a life of espionage. The school prepared Morris to operate as a Nelegal, or an illegal agent for the NKVD, predecessor to the KGB. The risks of such work were extremely high. The penalty for spying against the U.S. was at least 30 years in prison or death. That meant secrecy was key. Morris couldn't be caught interacting with a Soviet. And so, his training emphasized the art of handing off intelligence without any human-to-human contact, specifically the Dubok, or dead drop. A favorite spot for a Dubok was a darkened movie theater. The asset would go in first, watch the movie for a bit, tape his envelope of documents under his seat, and then get up and leave. While the rest of the audience was consumed with the movie, a second agent would slip in and retrieve the documents. But Morris didn't mention any of his new skills in his letters to that blonde-haired girl, Leontine Pietka, or Lona. In fact, Morris's work as a spy would remain unknown to Lona until after they wed in July of 1941. Admittedly, Lona was on the fence about marrying Morris. At the time, she was seeing 2 men, Morris and a wealthy lawyer. She was torn. Marrying the lawyer would mean extra money to donate to party causes. Besides, Morris was far away in Spain, and Lona was looking for a partner. But Morris did appreciate her, and she liked that. As he put it, Lona could disarm a man with just one of her seductive looks. That came in mighty useful to her later. However, I set my mind firmly on winning that girl's favor. In order to decide on a husband, she sought the advice of a trusted party member, who, according to biographer Barnes Carr, told her to marry the poor guy and work together with him for communism. She heeded his advice. Once Morris returned from Spain, he and Lona were married on July 13, 1941. It was a small civil ceremony in Norwich, Connecticut, near Lona's childhood home. At the time, her occupation was listed as a governess and his as a steward. Lona was still unaware of her new husband's true profession. But it couldn't be kept secret for long. Just weeks before the wedding, Hitler had orchestrated an invasion of Russia. It was almost time for Morris to put his espionage training to use. He only hoped that his new wife would join him. Coming up, Morris Cohen breaks the news of his true profession to his wife. Now back to the story. In July 1941, Morris and Lona Cohen were newly married, but Lona was still unaware of Morris's work as a Soviet spy. That was about to change. Morris poured them each a cup of tea, then took her hand. He needed to tell her something. He paused. Lona began to worry. Was he sick? Did someone die? Were they having financial problems? He assured her that everything was all right. He reminded her of the beautiful life he'd promised her. and assured her that what he was about to tell her was in service of that promise. Finally, he told her he'd been trained as a Soviet spy. Lona gasped. She quickly pulled her hand from his. Who was this man? How many lies had he told her over the course of their relationship? A liar and a traitor? A traitor to his country? How could he think of putting himself and her in this kind of danger? Of course, she shared his values as a communist, but working on behalf of the Soviet government was anti-American. But Morris, always so good with his words, pleaded with her. He wasn't anti-American, just anti-fascist. He was fighting for universal truth and justice. He was acting in good faith. Lona eyed him carefully, still uncertain of his intentions. He asked her why she had decided to marry him. Lona admitted that it was to work together for the good of the Communist Party. He insisted that was exactly what he was doing, and he wanted nothing more than to carry out this work alongside her. Moscow had already expressed interest in Lona. They felt a husband and wife team could have great impact. As Lona heard these words, she softened. She knew her husband was noble and well-intentioned, and perhaps, working together, they could make a real difference. She declared that they would have both a love marriage and a spy marriage. The Moscow Center was thrilled. Morris and Lona were given the code names Lewis and Leslie. Their espionage careers began alongside America's wartime effort. Later that year, in December of 1941, the United States entered World War II. As the international battles raged on, the Coens began technical and industrial espionage projects for the Soviets, stealing small bits of information about U.S. wartime production. Until, in mid-1942, Morris was drafted into the U.S. Army, leaving Lona to carry on alone. With each new mission, she acquired more confidence and know-how, but nothing could prepare her for what was to come. In 1942, Donald McLean, a member of the Soviets' Cambridge spy ring, worked as a mole inside the Foreign Office in London. In a 60-page report to Moscow, he detailed British plans to build a uranium-235 bomb, the force of which would be unimaginable. Shortly thereafter, Anatoly Gorsky, another Soviet spy in London, reported that, due to lack of funding, Britain planned to join forces with Canada and the United States to build the bomb. The Soviets needed intel on that collaborative project. The job would require skill, finesse, and a bit of charm, which is why Lona Cohen came to mind. Anatoly Yatskov, the Cohen's control officer, sat across from Lona. He was responsible for overseeing Soviet assets or agents working in the field. Today, his face was serious and his voice stern. Although extremely skilled as a spy, Lona had developed a reputation for being tardy and forgetting passcodes. This mission was far too important for those simple mistakes. Security and paranoia were at an all-time high during the war. Even the slightest hint of strange movements, odd clothing, evasive looks, or nervous tics could trigger suspicion. And if they were going to infiltrate the Manhattan Project, Lona would need to operate with extreme caution. The Manhattan Project was the code name given to the American-led effort to create the atomic bomb. The project cost $2 billion. That's worth more than $26 billion in today's currency. Yatskov explained that the project was headquartered in the isolated and unsuspecting city of Los Alamos, New Mexico. Due to the extreme sensitivity of the operations there, the Army Corps of Engineers worked tirelessly to keep it under wraps. Locals were forbidden to discuss the city or its happenings. The town went undocumented on driver's licenses, birth certificates, and mail. The city itself was effectively non-existent, making the Manhattan Project extremely difficult for the Soviets to find. That is, until the director of the project, Major General Leslie Groves, began recruiting physicists to participate, regardless of their political affiliations. Well, this approach garnered some of the most cutting-edge talent. It also attracted scientists with radical counterculture ideologies, scientists like Ted Hall. Ted Hall was recruited to Los Alamos at only 18 years old, but he was already loyal to the communist cause. He, like the Coens, had suffered during the worldwide economic depression. He too felt disgusted by the rise of the Nazis in Germany and the fascists in Spain. It was no major leap to realize that aiding Russia was the best path toward a more equitable world. When Ted made contact with the NKVD, they asked for proof that he earnestly wanted to help the Soviets. Ted readily supplied it, in the form of an extensive report on the Allied A-bomb. Now, Lona Cohen would be the one to collect the next round of intel from Ted Hall. Danger aside, the mission was simple. She was to disguise herself as a tourist and rent a room in Sandia, a small mountain resort east of Albuquerque. If anyone asked, she was to say that she'd come to New Mexico for health reasons. Then, at 1 o'clock on Sunday afternoon, she would go to the Cathedral of St. John. This was where she'd meet Ted. Once they made contact, she was to get physically close to him, as though they were old friends. They would walk together for a while before making the pass. Lona's heart raced at the weight of the task at hand. This mission could easily end in arrest, in jail time, in the death penalty. But her thoughts drifted to Morris, who was still away at war, of the promise she'd made to him, of their shared desire to fight for the oppressed. It was up to her to see through that vision while he was away. She took the challenge. Then, the unexpected happened. On July 16, 1945, the United States tested its first atomic bomb in Alamogordo, New Mexico. Alan Taylor of The Atlantic wrote, "The test, codenamed Trinity, unleashed an explosion with the energy of about 20 kilotons of TNT. The blast was felt more than 200 miles away. It was no longer possible to conceal. It was clear the U.S. nuclear efforts were rapidly progressing. The Soviet mission to intercede was more pressing than ever." Lona was making the usual commute to her job in the civilian workforce, a cover for her espionage work. Suddenly, a man grabbed her elbow. She was startled, and even more so when she realized it was Yatskov. This unplanned meeting was highly unusual, but the test explosion needed an immediate reaction. There was no time to waste. She was to leave for New Mexico the next day. Yatskov sent her to the doctor, where she complained of a persistent sore throat and cough. She was given a diagnosis of chronic bronchitis and granted sick leave from work. The mission was underway, but the path to Ted Hall would be anything but easy. It was late July 1945. The midday sun blazed overhead. Lona wiped her brow as she made her way through Albuquerque to the Cathedral of St. John. Yatskov's words echoed in her head. "You have talent as an actress. Use that gift." She was a tourist. Focus on being a tourist. So Lona wandered about, admiring local architecture as she walked the narrow streets and sidewalks. She had time to kill. She'd heeded Yatskov's warning and arrived early to the meeting spot. But finally, the clock struck one, and Ted was nowhere in sight. Lona checked her watch. Did she have the wrong date? the wrong address? Perhaps she'd blown the mission. What should she do? She quickly realized she couldn't stay where she was. Loitering could be perceived as suspicious behavior, and paranoia in Los Alamos was high. She waited 20 minutes before crossing the street to avoid attracting attention. At 2 o'clock, she returned to the cathedral. Ted was still nowhere to be found. Lona returned to the cathedral the following Sunday, hopeful that she'd mistaken the dates. Once again, she played the tourist, admiring the scenery as she made her way down the street. Her palms were sweaty with anticipation. At 1 o'clock, she stood waiting outside of the cathedral, hoping to find the man with a grocery sack with a fishtail hanging out of the bottom, their chosen recognition signal. And once again, she came up empty-handed. Lona decided to send a telegram to Yatskov at her address, as he'd instructed. She wrote that Harry, Ted's codename, had not shown up for his cure. Her time for sick leave was limited. What should she do? Yatskov insisted that she wait and try again. She did, and she nearly ruined the entire operation in the process. Coming up, Lona almost blows her cover, and she and Morris are forced to flee for their lives. Now, back to the story. It had been weeks since Lona Cohen arrived in New Mexico. Her mission was to retrieve the plans for the Allied A-bomb from Ted Hall, a scientist at Los Alamos. But her efforts to this point had failed. By August 6, 1945, she was too late. The United States dropped its first atomic bomb on Hiroshima. According to the U.S. Department of Energy, Little Boy was a 9,700-pound uranium gun-type bomb. The yield of the explosion was later estimated at 15,000 tons of TNT. The arms race was heating up, but Ted was still missing in action. On Lona's third trip to the cathedral, at their appointed meeting point, she spotted a man carrying a yellow paper grocery sack, reminiscent of the one Ted was supposed to carry. She squinted, taking in the sight of the older, heavier man. He didn't seem to match the picture her control officer had given her, but it had been 3 weeks. She was growing tired and desperate for results. She took a chance, one that could have proven deadly. She approached the heavyset man and boldly offered the parole. Well, this was a code used by intelligence agents to identify one another. In this case, it was, "Excuse me, do you know which is the best resort for respiratory disorders, Sandia or the Rio Grande?" Lona waited for the proper response. It never came. She glanced at the man's grocery bag. There was no fishtail in sight. This wasn't Ted. Her heart began to race. The man asked if she needed assistance. Lona had to defuse the situation, fast. She once more remembered Yatskov's words to her. She was an actress. It was time to act. Harnessing her fear, she said dramatically, "No, no one can do anything for me. I have to carry my cross alone." Possibly trying to capitalize on the apparent damsel in distress, the man began to flirt with her. Lona withdrew, disgusted, but also relieved. Yatskov seemed to be right about Lona's acting potential. It may have saved her life. Still, Lona hadn't found Ted, and she was growing desperate. 3 Sundays had already passed. On the 4th Sunday, Lona packed her bags and checked out of her hotel. She was sure she'd already failed, and that she might even be in imminent danger. But she would try one more time. She made her way over to the cathedral, and on the way, she spotted something. A man in a white sport shirt, straw hat, and sandals. He held a yellow grocery bag with a fishtail hanging out of the bottom. Lona's heart pounded. Stifling her adrenaline, she made her way up to the man. She stopped him, and he responded curtly, "Yes, what is it?" Her previous mistake haunted her. What if this wasn't Ted? Just a mere coincidence. But this was her last chance, and she was desperate for a win. She asked the man, "You brought it?" "Yes, I brought something," he whispered, gesturing towards the bag. He stared at her expectantly. Lona realized it was time to offer the parole, but her mind went blank. All of these weeks of waiting had her on edge and off her game. What was the code? She stared blankly at Ted's concerned face for one paralyzing moment, but finally, it came to her. "Excuse me, would you know which is the best resort for respiratory disorders? Sandia or the Rio Grande?" The man replied, "The place where the climate is the best is in the Rocky Mountains. There's a good doctor there. Ted Hall, at last." He looked around quickly before retrieving a collection of papers from his grocery bag and slipping them into Lona's handbag. Per Yatskov's instructions, the two walked arm in arm, as though they were lovers or long-lost friends. This familiarity was sure to diffuse any suspicion until they finally parted ways. The plan had worked, if belatedly, but Lona's mission was far from complete. She now faced the daunting task of getting the materials to the Soviets. First, the train back to New York. Lona made her way back to the station and bought a ticket. She walked out onto the platform, and what she saw stopped her in her tracks. Just ahead, passengers were being stopped for questioning by men in suits, either local police or federal agents. Worse, they were inspecting personal items. There was no way out of Albuquerque without inspection. If caught, she'd be arrested, or worse. The papers in her possession were among the most coveted in the world. Any country would pay millions for them. She needed somewhere secure to hide the documents. Not in her suitcase or purse, they would be inspected. Inside her blouse wouldn't do either. A female agent would search her if she were taken in for questioning. She needed to be resourceful, and she needed, once again, to act. Lona made her way back to the station and into the ladies' room. She grabbed a Kleenex box, removed a few tissues from the top, and slid the papers under them. She would use the Kleenex box to support her claim of bronchitis. She tucked her ticket into a book in her purse. What transpired next would be lauded by the Soviets as some of the most resourceful and shrewd intelligence work in history. Back on the platform, Lona waited to board the train. As predicted, the officers stopped her for inspection. They asked to see her ID and inspector bags. She acquiesced, showing them her prescription as well, and explaining that she had been in Albuquerque for health reasons. They asked for her ticket. She fumbled. She knew it was there somewhere. She shifted the Kleenex box from one hand to another while she rifled through her belongings, then finally handed the box to the officer. A bold move. The unsuspecting officer had in his hand some of the most destructive plans known to man. The conductor yelled, "All aboard!" Lona was still searching for her ticket. The other officer pointed to the book in her handbag. Was that it? Lona thanked him gratefully and boarded the train. It slowly began to chug out of the station. But the officer was still on the platform holding her Kleenex box. Lona faked a sneeze and gestured for the tissues, waving out the window as she pulled away. The officer ran to catch up to the train and gave her the box. Lona had successfully passed the security checkpoint. When she arrived back in New York, she left a chalk mark on a wall between two gutters. This was her signal to Yatskov that she had returned. He was delighted. As a young, relatively new spy, she'd already executed a monumental mission for the Soviets, one that would send her soaring through the ranks of their most revered agents. According to Cohen biographer Barnes Carr, Yatskov would later say that the information acquired in this mission enabled the Soviets to gain time building their own bomb. How much time gained is hard to tell, but a few years at least. If it had not been for the information that other people were developing a bomb, they would not have started their own effort until the end of the war. Morris Cohen was extremely impressed with his wife's cunning as well. He looked forward to rejoining Lona once he was discharged from the army. Little did he know that their opportunity to help the Soviets would be suddenly cut short. Two immensely consequential defections would lead to the capture and dissolution of a spy ring led by Julius and Ethel Rosenberg, with irreparable effects on the Coens. Thank you for listening to Espionage. We'll be back Friday with a new episode about atomic spies Morris and Lona Cohen. For more information, we found Operation Whisper, the capture of Soviet spies Morris and Lona Cohen by Barnes Carr, especially helpful to our research. You can find more episodes of Espionage, as well as all of Parcast's other shows on Spotify or anywhere else you listen to podcasts. Several of you have asked how to help us. If you enjoy the show, the best way to help is to leave a 5-star review. And don't forget to follow us on Facebook and Instagram at Parcast and Twitter at Parcast Network. We'll be back next week with another deep dive into the world of clandestine operation. Espionage was created by Max Cutler and is a Parcast Studios original. Executive producers include Max and Ron Cutler. Sound designed by Dick Schroeder, with production assistance by Ron Shapiro, Carly Madden, Isabella Way, and Joel Stein. This episode of Espionage was written by Natalie McKieran, with writing assistance by Kate Gallagher, and stars Carter Roy.